My name is Joyce Coleman, and I'm here again with Dr. Marion Namenworth. The date is April 10th, 2004, and we're going to continue the interview that we started 2 weeks ago. So, Dr. Namenworth, I think you wanted to begin by amplifying on some comments you made last week about how women and men were socialized into different roles.
Yes. I found that when I actually began working as an assistant professor, that the way the research situation was structured, or the way the department was structured, and the expectations that senior department members had about how a junior faculty member would act, was related to a lot of the characteristics of men in our society, or what men are trained to do,
mm-hmm.
and didn't suit so well the way women were had been trained in our society, the way women are socialized from childhood to adulthood. And for example, women are or girls are encouraged and expected to be helpful and supportive and not be particularly self-promoting,
mm-hmm.
and to do what needs to be done without making a lot of noise about it, and generally to help out and make the system work. That, you know, women are sustainers,
mm-hmm.
and they're rewarded for that. And that did affect me, too, in my upbringing, even though, as I mentioned before, my mother was a, you know, very leader-like person in the family and was very successful in business, working outside the home and all of that. So even though I never questioned that women are leaders and very bright and creative and so forth, I still thought of women also as doing what needs to be done to keep things going,
mm-hmm.
and not showboating about it. And I found, to my amazement, that in the department, when I agreed to do things that needed to be done, like serve on a lot of committees and do quite a lot of teaching, much more in both those categories than new or relatively new male faculty were doing,
mm-hmm.
I did it because I thought it was important, and that the rest of the faculty thought it was important, and that it would be considered positively and also acknowledged as taking up time and effort.
Mm-hmm.
And men tended to, the similarly situated young male faculty tended to try and teach as little as possible, did not serve on very many committees, and of course there was also the problem that there were only very, very few women faculty on tenure track at that time, you know, because
mm-hmm.
we were breaking ground there. I was the only tenure track woman faculty member in the department for the first few years I was there,
mm-hmm.
and so there was this artificial pressure to get women on every conceivable university and department committee so that it would look as though women were participating in the governance of the university. And also, of course, you know, for example, I served on admissions committees and hiring committees.
Hmm.
There was a desire to have women's voices heard, or at least to perceive that it would be perceived that one was doing that. And so I agreed to a lot of this, but of course it took up a lot of time, and it turned out that, first of all, I found one problem with doing administrative work and teaching is that it takes time from your research, and there came a time approximately my fourth year of on the faculty where I was supposed to have a semester off from teaching, and then at the last minute, the department chairman at the time came and asked if I would teach a large course anyway because there just wasn't another faculty member available at that time,
mm-hmm.
who could fill the slot easily. And I uncharacteristically said, I really wish you wouldn't ask me to do that because, I'm going to come up for tenure soon. I need the time for research. I've been doing much more teaching than other young faculty and so forth. And the chairman at the time, I think Dr. Burns, did agree and back off and say, okay. But I found out later that this was not taken well by other department members,
mm-hmm.
or by some other department members. And it made me feel uncomfortable that I had declined, although I felt it was the right thing to do. But I think, looking back on it, that they wouldn't even have asked a young male faculty member to do that, because they would have been more respectful of their need to have time for research.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you know, the teaching loads of the male faculty were considerably less than what I was expected to do. So that's an example of how expectations for women, which were sort of sociological and related to the way women and men are raised in Western society, fed into a disparity between the way women and men were treated. I mean,
mm-hmm.
they gave me more teaching and administrative work to do than men. They expected me to do it. They didn't like it if I declined. I felt that I should do it because of the way I'd been socialized. But then when it came time to evaluate me for tenure, they did not really value that I did this teaching and administration beyond what others were asked to do, and faulted me for and not having generated enough research based articles. So that would be an example of how society's expectations and the way girls and boys are socialized or were socialized at that time created a difference between the way male and female young faculty were treated at the university.
Okay. Now, maybe we could talk a little bit more about your research. Now, can you talk about the funding you were given and whether the facilities you were given were adequate for your research?
Yes. In fact, I had magnificent facilities because I moved into the lab that had recently been vacated by Dr. Kurland, who had just left the university before I came. He was a molecular biologist and had enormous facilities, certainly for a new faculty member. So in that sense, I walked into an excellent situation. Also, the University of Wisconsin at the time, and probably still, was very generous, or let's say very able, to support, to contribute internal setup funds for new science faculty. And so the, you know, package of equipment and space and money that I got to set up the lab and get going was just excellent, and it was a strong component of my choosing to come to Wisconsin rather than go somewhere else to begin a career.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it was just time that was the problem then.
Excuse me?
It was just time that was the problem. You were given sufficient facilities and...
Oh, yes. No, okay. It was only time. And then, of course, I, you know, applied for research grants after I came and, you know, was funded by NSF and so forth.
Okay.
In fact, that became a problem later, though, because I was so short of time and distracted by other tasks, although I got, research grants and worked on them around the fourth or fifth year of my being on the faculty, I needed to reapply for grants, and I fell behind in the effort to reapply, and so that then created a more difficult situation when I came up for tenure, because I had not yet had a second round of grants approved.
So
the department, as it would have been typical for a research oriented university, considered the quantity of grants that you bring in very important, and I didn't fully take that on board.
Okay.
I was thinking more in terms of quality of research and maybe quantity of research, but rather than dollars brought in. I think that created problems when I was considered for tenure.
Okay. And what research projects were you working on here?
Well, primarily I began working on an effort to study how molecules, particularly proteins and to some extent RNA molecules, are spa- spatially localized in eggs before they begin developing, and I was using frog eggs as the example.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had developed a method of dividing the different regions of the frog egg into different test tubes, so to speak, by freezing the eggs and using a microtome to slice them, a cryostat
mm-hmm.
microtome to slice them. And then we were doing essentially biochemical experiments on the different fractions, and the basic idea was to try and identify molecules that were important, particularly proteins, that were important in initiating the development of eggs, in molecules important in starting the differentiation of the different regions of the egg, by identifying them because they might have been spatially localized in particular regions. So the idea was, if you have molecules A, B, C, D, and E, if you find that molecule C is very much concentrated in the area where the brain is going to form, that would suggest that you should study molecule C a little more to see whether it might not have an important role in initiating brain development.
Okay.
So these were experiments on the molecules that are responsible potentially for initiating the first steps of development. So that was the main focus of the lab, in a way. But I was also, at least in terms of the graduate students, some of the graduate students working in my lab, I was continuing along the line of my own graduate research, which was on limb regeneration in salamanders.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly one of the master students in my lab did considerable research on how cells specialize during limb regeneration in salamanders, and particularly on the question of to what extent can cells that have specialized to become a certain type of tissue, for example, muscle cells or cartilage cells, to what extent can they divide and then give rise to cells that specialize in a different direction during the course of limb regeneration, or is the specialization so firm and irreversible that all the progeny of a muscle cell can only differentiate as muscle cells?
Hmm.
I had worked on that question for my PhD, and there were further sub-questions that evolved from that, and so that was continued by a graduate student in the lab also.
Okay.
So there were those two areas.
Okay. Now, perhaps you've talked a little bit about teaching already and how you had a heavy teaching load. Do you remember what classes you taught?
Well, the major task was to teach an introductory course that was intended for students who were not going to major in biology,
mm-hmm.
and or at least that was their initial idea. Some of them changed their minds once they were in the course, but it was a course that, you know, a science and society type course that it was called something like Biological Principles and Their Impact on Society.
Okay.
And I taught that one semester each year, and the course had an enrollment limited to something like 200 students,
mm-hmm.
and it was both lecture and lab, and of course they were subdivided into many labs, and so there were teaching assistants, and it was, a lecture with a couple of hundred students, which met, I think, three times a week, and you know, plus the lab. And so that I taught that one semester of each year. I think that there was one year where I might have taught it both semesters. And then the other semester, I would teach part of, I would like co-teach a graduate seminar
mm-hmm.
with another faculty member. And contributing maybe 2 weeks or so of, about 2 weeks of material, I think both lectures and labs, to the development undergraduate developmental biology course.
Mm-hmm.
And this teaching load was quite a bit, even though it was modest compared to some other departments. The usual teaching load in the zoology department at the time was quite a bit less than that. And one way in which it was less was that, let's say, for the other developmental biology faculty, and for example, Jack Lillian at the time when I came was a junior faculty member, not yet tenured in the developmental biology area. I think the heaviest part of his teaching load was to co-teach the developmental biology undergraduate course. So
mm-hmm.
I don't know what the enrollment might have been. Maybe, you know, it might have been 100 students or something in both lectures and labs. But, you know, several people together taught that course, so that he would have been responsible for only, you know, a third of, let's say, of the lectures and labs
mm-hmm.
in that course. And then, you know, there would be a, you know, graduate seminar or something, or part of a graduate seminar the other semester. So that would be an example of the difference in teaching loads in the department.
Okay. Now, this large lecture course you were teaching for non-science students, would that have been considered a very undesirable course to teach for their faculty? I'm wondering if they would have preferred to teach the science majors or the graduate students. And did that sort of shift
yes
the burden?
No, some of the faculty in the department were very good teachers, or at least at times in their careers they were very good teachers. This would kind of wax and wane, because sometimes they would, you know, some of them would get preoccupied with other things and they weren't so good, but they had the reputation of having been, you know, really very magnetic, you know, and fascinating teachers. So I think it is true that they would, it was more prestigious to teach and more desirable for a biologist to teach potential majors, but I wouldn't say it, so I guess it's true, but I want to say that in the department, there, even among the most excellent and successful research faculty, there were some faculty who were also excellent teachers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one who was really, you know, outstanding in that area was Dr. Crow, who actually was jointly appointed in zoology and genetics.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess his name was James Crow.
Yes.
And he was, you know, an excellent human geneticist with a, you know, very fine and deserved research reputation, and also a totally excellent teacher. And he certainly gave a lot of public lectures, and I invited him to give guest lectures in my introductory course. Whether he would have taken on teaching a whole course of that kind, I don't know, but he certainly would have been great at it.
Okay, so it does sound like teaching was valued in the department then, and
not in the tenure evaluation, I would say, because those faculty who did minimal teaching and or who were not particularly good at it, you know, did not seem to be seriously faulted for it. There was a young male faculty member who was a, you know, sort of being considered for tenure in the, you know, maybe I think right before me, and you know, he was a slightly shy sort of person, I guess, and just didn't do well with large numbers of students, and you know, they went ahead, you know, it was so typical. I mean, the department was very empathetic with him, and you know, they liked him, and I liked him, and he, you know, was good at research, and he was good in small group discussions, and so they just said, well, you know, he just doesn't do well in larger classes, and you know, they overlooked the fact that he had done very little teaching, and that he signed up for a reasonable amount of teaching only the year before he was coming up for tenure, which
mm-hmm.
I found totally embarrassing, and you know, like, how, why would he embarrass himself that way, in the sense of to do something so obviously manipulative
mm-hmm.
in terms of his tenure consideration, which was coming up. But the department just loved it. I mean, they thought it was just fine, and they, you know, so so in that sense, I don't think that that the valuing of quality teaching really existed where it counted. You
okay.
know, when you know, on I mean, they would give lip service to it, and I think that people did admire each other for the extent to which they were really good teachers, but they certainly weren't interested in. They weren't going to credit it compared to research at all.
Okay, okay. Did you enjoy teaching?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Now, we've been mentioning the tenure process, and maybe now we can talk specifically about it. What were your expectations? What did you know about the tenure process when you first arrived at UW?
Well, I think when I arrived, I, you know, knew very little about it, you know, except what it was, you know, that they would make a judgment after you'd been there a few years about whether you could be tenured and that it was necessary to get tenure to stay at a university. But then I lucked into the situation, which I'm sure was very unusual, that the department around the time that I came or the year before I came or something like that had voted that non-tenured faculty could sit in on the deliberations for tenure of other faculty.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that that had been done so that faculty would have some idea of what it was all about before they came up for tenure themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And although I really don't know what led to that decision. And so in the first few years that I was in the department, I sat in on at least two proceedings for, you know, faculty discussions. I mean, I wasn't there by the time that we're voting, but the early rounds of discussions
mm-hmm.
about whether somebody merited tenure, which took place in a faculty meeting. And that was very informative, because I, of course, I knew these faculty and knew a little about their research or more in the case of people close to my area. So, and then I would listen to the faculty evaluate this work and, you know, saw the way it was presented. And, you know, for example, that there was a particular faculty member assigned to promote and defend the promotion of each candidate
mm-hmm.
so that there would be a sort of, you know, lawyer, so to speak, for an advocate
okay.
for the candidate who would present the work and defend it against the probes and, you know, questioning
mm-hmm.
by the other faculty. And I developed a sense of how the faculty were quite considerate and searching in evaluating the candidate and realized that different individuals develop challenges. You know, the challenge might be grant funding, or it might be that they were being distracted by something that happened in their private lives or that their personalities were creating problems in this area and strength in this area. And I was quite struck by how generous the department seemed to be in their evaluations. And in fact, they went ahead and granted enthusiastically, voted for tenure for every other faculty member in the department. So I sat in on at least two, maybe even three of these considerations.
Okay.
And probably only two. Okay. I think somewhere during the time I was there, I think they might have stopped that system, so non-tenured faculty couldn't go anymore to those discussions. But anyway, I got an idea of what it would be like, but it turned out that it was totally misleading because when it came to my turn, they didn't seem to operate that way at all.
Okay. Were you given feedback every few years about how you were doing and how people felt about your work?
Hardly at all, and this was a problem. I think this task was probably assigned to the chairman of the department, and the chairman during much of my time there was a kind of shy person, or at least a person who didn't feel comfortable going to another faculty member, and particularly a woman faculty member, and telling her that this and that was a worry to the department or something like that. So I got very little feedback, and I also didn't you know, I mean, looking back on it, I should have corralled people and asked them how I was doing and how, what I needed to worry about or change. And I didn't do that, and it was not that I couldn't talk to people. I mean, people were definitely friendly, and I, you know, it's easy for me to think of who I could have gone to, but I didn't realize that there were, you know, that I needed to find that out. You know, I thought it was obvious to me what my strengths and weaknesses were, but on the other hand, I expected them to be evaluated along the lines that I saw them evaluating the men who were considered before me, and that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. So, but I didn't realize that until it was too late.
Okay. So there was no one in the department who was sort of like a mentor to you?
No, and I think that, I don't know to what extent that was supposed to, I guess it was supposed to be happening. I don't know. I don't know who it would have been. There were three other developmental biology faculty, one of whom was an assistant professor when I first came, and then was promoted, and the other two were already tenured faculty when I came. And if one of them was supposed to be my mentor, I don't know. In any case, I don't recall any particular time of being taken aside and told to do this or that, or even, you know, to being evaluated by them or anything like that. I talk to them on a daily basis, but we, you know, we never had a session like that, unless I'm forgetting something.
Okay. Now, what year did you come up for tenure?
I asked to not be considered, I think, until my sixth year, because at that time, you know, I was hoping to reapply for grants, and especially I had a lot of research data that hadn't been published yet, and I, you know, felt it was important to get that stuff accepted in journals and so forth, and that had happened to considerable extent by my sixth year. So I think they would have considered me in my fourth or fifth year, but if I remember, I know I asked them to postpone the consideration, and I think that meant that it was my sixth year when I was considered, but I could be wrong.
Okay. Now tell me a little bit about what happened then when you asked to be considered for tenure.
Well, it was automatic. You don't ask. I mean,
okay.
So I have to say that I don't remember I was asked to submit some documentation like a vita and you know, a publication list and, you know, a list of the teaching I'd done and that kind of thing. But I don't remember any other kind of preparation. I don't remember meeting with any particular person or being aware that a particular person was in charge of the of presenting my case or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I will have to put the proviso in here continually that I, you know, it's possible that I'm just not remembering this completely, but I don't recall being aware of any particular person as the go-to person to consider, to ask about how things were going and
mm-hmm.
what else was needed and so forth.
Okay.
Other than maybe the chairman of the department, who I think was again then William Burns. Dr. Abramson had been chairman for a few years, and I think then perhaps Dr. Burns was chairman again.
Okay. Okay, well then when did you first hear the news your tenure, your tenure application was then turned down?
What happened was that there was a virtually split vote in the department, you know, with, I don't remember how many department members there were, but let's say, you know, it was like a 12-11 vote or something like that.
Okay.
In favor of tenure. And the procedure is to then the recommendation for tenure and the vote and the documentation and so forth is put together and sent to the divisional committee, the Biological Sciences Committee, which includes faculty members of different departments,
mm-hmm.
and is chaired by a dean, I believe, and then that they decide whether to follow the department's so-called recommendation. I say so-called in this case, since it was a split, mm-hmm. or to turn it down. And,
okay.
And so it was turned down at the divisional committee level, but it was clear to me that this was because of the very divided opinion in the department, and also because, and I suspected that probably individuals who were, you know, were against my promotion had talked to divisional committee members and encouraged them to turn it down.
Okay.
I don't know whether that's the case, but I presume it's the case.
Okay. And how did you react to the news?
Well, I was surprised and amazed and thought that it wouldn't stand. And, you know, because I felt that it was way out of line with the decisions that had been made on my predecessors. In other words, I felt that the sum total of research, teaching and administration, or let's say just research and teaching and administration, really wasn't valued. That the sum total of research and teaching that I had done was clearly within the same ballpark as that of several male faculty members that they had promoted during the time that I was there. And in fact, they hadn't turned anybody down at all. You know, they had promoted each one that came up. And so I felt that, you know, they didn't have a leg to stand on, and that if I, you know, if I documented in a comparative way what I had done versus what others in the department who were promoted had done, then the divisional committee would realize that this was way out of line and would, you know, reverse their decision. And so I put together a comparative document, you know, comparing the research and publications and teaching loads of the several males who had been promoted to tenure in the preceding 5 years, compared that, and I think I even included the person considered right after me who was also, the following year, who was also promoted, and, you know, compared that to my publications, research, and teaching, and, you know, this, you know, sent it to the divisional committee, and you know, of course, people in the department saw it, and so there was sort of turmoil about it for quite a while. But you know, they just reaffirmed their old position. Although they did give me an extra year to, you know, to be on the faculty. I think I must have been there 8 years altogether because of that. But as a result, I ended up filing a sex discrimination complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and the Labor Department, and ended up suing the university under Title VII of the, I guess it's the Civil Rights Act, I don't know, but, you know, the law that had been passed against discrimination in employment.
Okay. Now, and just to clarify, when you said they let you stay for an extra year, that was the divisional committee that allowed you to stay?
Well, I suppose, I don't know, the chancellor or the whoever makes that decision, you know, it's made at the top of the administration. But, you know, undoubtedly it was an effort by the, you know, with the advice of the legal advisors of the university to sort of provide something to compensate me or to discourage me from, you know, suing the university.
Okay, so this was not an extra year in which you could try to perhaps accomplish more research and gain tenure. This was one more year with the understanding that you still would not be given tenure at the end.
Yes, by the eighth year, yeah.
Okay.
Whether there was another consideration after the sixth year, I don't, you know, like in the seventh year, I don't think so. I don't remember it, but I don't think so.
Okay. Now, meanwhile, how were other women on campus reacting? I mean, did you find support among other women for your case?
Oh, yeah, in, you know, like with the Association of Faculty Women and so on. Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Now, can you tell me a bit more about your lawsuit against the university and how that went?
Well, the procedure at the time, anyway, was that under Title VII, you needed to file with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. They would handle it, and also maybe through EEOC or indirectly, the Labor Department became involved, the U.S. Labor Department. So, at the time, EEOC was swamped, and so you were required to file with them, but they were actually dealing with only a very tiny fraction of the cases submitted. So the legalism was that after they had the case for at least 6 months or something like that, then you could go forward with a lawsuit. They would have to allow you to go forward with a lawsuit even if they hadn't had the chance to investigate it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it went. I don't remember any signs that they really investigated it, but I don't know for sure. The Labor Department did investigate it. They sent people to interview me and others and looked at the documentation and so forth, and they found in my favor. I mean, they said that it looked as though that this was unequal treatment and so forth, but I just went ahead with the lawsuit. I mean, the Labor Department, you know, it was not in the position of bringing lawsuits.
Okay.
I don't think they did that. So, you know, that they, I guess, filed a report, you know, to tell the university what they thought. But meanwhile, I had hired a lawyer and went ahead with a Title VII discrimination suit. And I did expect that that the university would just back off and reconsider, because I didn't think that this, you know, I thought on its face that they had a losing case.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I realized that it was difficult to win, you know, because other people were filing these lawsuits at other universities, excuse me. But we went ahead with the lawsuit, and, you know, I know, I was expecting the university would, you know, cave, that it would, you know, might not actually go to trial.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you know, as it got closer to trial, there were some feelers put out about settlement amounts and so on. But I had, you know, made it clear to my lawyer and he to them that, you know, I wasn't interested in the settlement, that I just was interested in, you know, continuing my job at the university.
Okay,
So we did go to trial.
Okay. Now, did that involve you testifying and members of the zoology department testifying?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it did.
And what was the final result of the lawsuit?
The result of the lawsuit was that we lost. There was, let's see, this was a lawsuit in front of a judge, and in fact, in front of a magistrate. Excuse me, I need to cough for a minute.
Oh, of course.
And I'm going to...
I'll just pause. Okay, we're back again.
This lawsuit was in front of a magistrate, and we had agreed to this person, the magistrate being in the acting as judge in the case. He was known to, you know, of course, the local legal people, and I was advised that he was a fair person.
Mm-hmm.
Now, during, you know, towards the end of the trial, he called us into a conference with him. Can we go back to pause for a minute?
Yes. Now, we're going to resume our conversation. You were just talking about a meeting with the magistrate.
Right. The magistrate called us, both lawyers, into his chambers and said that he had just accepted a job offer. I believe it, I think it was working in the Attorney General's office, in the office of the State Attorney General. And this meant that he would be working for the prosecutor of the case, or for the state attorney. In other words, the state, I don't remember the exact legal structure here, but the university was being defended. Since I had sued the university, and it's a state university, the university was being defended by the state of Wisconsin Attorney General's office.
Mm-hmm.
So the magistrate, who was the judge in the trial, had just agreed, had been offered a job in that entity.
Okay.
And had accepted it. So, you know, he was asking us, so do you want to, you know, have me end the trial and start all over again, because, you know, you might consider me not a neutral party now,
mm-hmm.
or do you want to continue with the trial? And so, you know, my lawyer and I discussed it, and because this man had the reputation of being honest, and I think my lawyer sort of knew him knew people who had worked with him and so forth, since Madison's not that big a place, you know, we felt on balance, you know, since it would be inordinately expensive and time-consuming to start all over again,
mm-hmm.
since this was fairly close to the end, we decided to say, okay, you know, why don't you just continue? And, you know, whether this was a good decision, I don't know. But anyway, he ended up, you know, ruling against us in a, you know, fairly mealy-mouthed way. And then, you know, as far as the content of this decision,
mm-hmm.
The verbal content of the decision, which took a long, long, long time in coming. And then we appealed this to the circuit court for the Seventh Circuit. And there we lost on a 2-1 decision. There were 3 judges.
Mm-hmm.
And the tenor of the majority's decision, I mean, you know, the way they explained their decision, was to say that tenure matters were not things that could be second-guessed by judges, because when evaluating research and teaching and so forth, this is something that experts must do, and that the faculty were the experts, and the judges were not in a position to second-guess
mm-hmm.
what the experts had decided.
Okay.
So they were essentially saying that courts couldn't be used to question decisions by faculty members,
mm-hmm.
and or that it... Posner was one of the judges, and he, you know, his... A guideline to his attitudes about the law was that there were certain things which it wasn't efficient to do, and might be desirable, but it just wasn't realistic, and made the system inefficient if you let courts get into certain areas that they, you know, really didn't function well in. So,
mm-hmm.
and I think he was a leading energy behind that sort of attitude. So, you know, so of the 3 judges, 1 voted in our favor, and he and 1 other voted against.
Okay. Now, this would have... how would, for example, the Association of University Faculty, Women Faculty, respond to this? Because this would really remove a lot of power from people who felt that they had been discriminated against.
Well, the Association of Faculty Women was very strongly backing me, and there was fundraising to try and raise funds to cover some of the expenses of this, and they were very supportive. Ruth Blyer was one of, you know, very energetic
mm-hmm.
person mobilizing forces to help, so by the time it was at the appeals court level, and I guess before also, there was a lot of support, and you know, there were articles in the student paper and to keep people informed of what was going on, and
mm-hmm.
there was a kind of movement of people to back me, and I suppose there were letters written and that kind of thing. Certainly within the university there were. Whether briefs were filed with the court, I don't know. Some people testified at the trial level on my behalf, and
would these have been your students or other women or faculty members?
Well, first of all, of course, the zoology department members were called to testify, but students were students, you know, in small numbers were called to testify, and I honestly can't remember whether other women on women faculty on campus. I mean, there were no women from the zoology department
mm-hmm.
testified, as far as I remember. There were none on tenure track for most of the time I was there, and I guess, let's say, there was another 1 or 2 assistant professors by the time that I was turned down for tenure, but they were junior faculty, and it
mm-hmm.
would have been they would have been put in a horrible position. If,
yes.
So they, you know, there were no senior women to testify in the zoology department, and I honestly can't remember whether other women, you know, like tenured faculty, even Ruth Blyer, I honestly can't remember whether she testified. It would have been a stretch, I think, sort of, you know, since these women from other departments wouldn't have really been in my research area or anything like that.
Yeah, okay. Now, when the final appeal was turned down, what did you do next?
Well, a lot of time elapsed. I mean, by the time at the appeals court level, that only happened in 1984. By that time, I had moved to the Twin Cities and doing research at the University of Minnesota and so forth.
Okay.
But I did stay around Madison for couple of extra years at least. I was on the, you know, since I stayed on the faculty for 8 years, that extended to 1979, and then I was working on the court case, helping my lawyer prepare for it and so on, and I did interviews on WORT radio and that kind of thing for a while. But then, at the beginning of 82, I moved to St. Paul and began working as a research associate in the genetics department at the University of Minnesota.
Okay. Okay. Now,
but I would go back and forth a lot, and of course there was the appeals process that was developing and that we had to prepare for and so forth.
Okay, and what finally happened in 1984 when you received news that it had been turned down?
Well, I just continued my life in the Twin Cities. I certainly, if I had won, I would have.
Okay, sorry. Please continue.
When I realized that, the appeals court effort had failed and, you know, that I wasn't going to get to go back to my position at the University of Wisconsin, I just continued my life in Minnesota, which consisted of a series of occasions to do research, and then I did some teaching at the University of Minnesota as an adjunct faculty member, not on tenure track, occasionally teaching genetics or cell biology when other faculty weren't available to do it. And also I, after a while, I began teaching on year-to-year contracts as a visiting assistant professor at McAllister College, and taught a variety of biology-type courses, genetics and developmental biology and cell and molecular biology, and also some feminist-oriented courses, like feminist perspectives on science-type courses, all at the at McAllister College.
Okay.
And now I've gone back to research. I'm working in the medical school at the University of Minnesota.
Okay. Now, you mentioned teaching some courses on feminism, and I wanted to ask you about your 1985 article called Science Through a Feminist Prism. And when I looked this article up on Google, it seemed like it had been assigned in many women's studies courses, so it's quite a popular article to assign. First of all, I wanted to ask, in the acknowledgments to this article, you mention a Women in Science reading group, a Women in Science study group at UW. And I think you talked a little bit about it last time. It was a group that was inspired by a talk given by Ruth Blyer. Can you recall any details about this group? And I'm also interested to know a bit more about Ruth Blyer and her role in it.
Yes. Well, as I mentioned, this group formed at the end of a lecture given by Ruth Blyer about feminist perspectives on science, and it really excited people. Ruth wasn't very inspiring person and an excellent lecturer and excellent scientist and so forth. And so people were so excited by her ideas that they asked her whether we could form a discussion group around these topics. And it became known as the, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, as the October 29th group, because it was October 29th was the date of Ruth's talk. And we began meeting every few weeks, and would these were all women scientists at various levels in the university, you know, some faculty and research associates and people in various kinds of scientific positions.
Mm-hmm.
And we would generally agree to read some article or part of a book in preparation for the discussion, and then orient our discussions around that reading that we had done. And I remember it vividly because it has continued until practically now. Of course, in the first years, it often was at Ruth Blyer's house, or she certainly even when it wasn't, she participated in these discussions and was a mainstay of the group.
Mm-hmm.
After her, you know, totally unfortunate, horrible death, we continued, and we have continued practically to this day, although about a year ago we decided it was getting too difficult to find times when all of us could meet, because in the interim, you know, a lot of participants had left town and moved to jobs elsewhere, and some of these people can come. Of course, I was one of them, because I've been living in the Twin Cities, but I was going down to Madison, you know, every month or two anyway, and then also, some people had taken jobs in Milwaukee and so on, but even so, we were finding our way back to Madison for these meetings and got a lot of energy and insight from it. I certainly did. I mean, I wasn't concerned or thinking about feminism in relation to science, you know, while I was on the faculty, you know, very much. I didn't, you know, I guess not getting tenure was a big impetus to start thinking about these things. But anyway, I certainly found these perspectives very thought-provoking and, you know, was interesting reading about these things. And it was also, just as with the Association of Faculty Women itself, it was exciting to be friends with other women from other disciplines who, you know, were in, had similar concerns and interests as I did. And so the group gradually became, you know, a combination, friends meeting to talk about stuff, and, you know, a serious discussion group about the feminist critique of science. And I have found it very, very interesting, and I think others did too, and we've kept it up. You know, many of our former members are, you know, on the East Coast or the West Coast, or there's one who's been working in British Columbia, and so we, you know, we certainly only a small group of members remaining near Madison are able to get back for any discussions now.
Okay. Can you tell me a bit more about Ruth Blyer? She's come up several times in conversation now, and can you just tell me, perhaps just describe her role on campus and what you think she did for women on campus?
Yes. Ruth Blyer was a very intelligent, very energetic, and magnetic person, and she had a lot of impact. She was a very driven person, a person who wanted to right all wrongs and make the world, you know, shake the world and make it be the way it's supposed to be. And I don't think she had any doubt about the way it's supposed to be and that it wasn't meeting her expectations.
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, she was very driven. She was very tough on herself and had very high standards for herself as a researcher in neurobiology, so she put a lot of energy and concentration into her work as a scientist, and she was definitely very successful and, you know, productive and, you know, did excellent work. But at the same time, she put a lot of energy and determination into helping the downtrodden. I mean, I was one of the downtrodden when I was, you know, getting shafted in the tenure process. But, you know, there were various conflicts in which women got the short end of the stick, and Ruth was determined to do everything that was possible in order to improve the situation, and she was quite fearless and bursting with energy, and so she became a real leader in the Association of Faculty Women, and into driving that association to organize around issues, and to and herself putting herself on the front line in organizing protests, whether written or whether involving marching or running or whatever. And so she, and also being a really fascinating person from my point of view, I presume other people found that too. You know, she could be a leader, you know, because she had the energy and she had the ideas, and people really loved her. They looked to her, they admired her, and so she was very important.
Hmm. And now, she edited the this volume in which your essay was published. Was this the only essay you wrote on the topic, or do you have other essays on the topic of feminism?
No, I think this is the only real essay. I think I might have given a talk or two, but this is the... I know our group wrote an analysis a couple of years after this, so I was just one author of in the whole group of that.
Okay.
But this one, I think, was the only one I wrote on my own, sort of.
Okay, and in what ways was this article informed by your experience at UW?
Oh, absolutely. You know, you mentioned it to me, and I went back and read it, when I hadn't read it or even thought about it for, you know, many years. So, yeah, it was very practically oriented. You know, it was really my emoting or declaring my surprise at the way things were organized in science as I had experienced them, you know, being a junior faculty member at Wisconsin, you know, and being surprised by the way it contrasts to what I expected. And, I mean, of course, it wasn't all new. I had been a graduate student and a postdoc, and to some extent had seen how things work. But I was really surprised by the degree to which the basic values of science, to some extent, took a back seat, went to, you know, manipulating to make yourself look better than what you were really are, than what you were really doing by, for example, I'll give, you know, just to give a little example, it was a totally common practice to multiply the number of publications that one had to one's credit by writing very repetitious publications in which each title included a sliver of new information,
mm-hmm.
Enhanced with a whole lot of information that had been published elsewhere. So if you worked on something for a couple of years and could easily have described it in a very good article, that was not an advisable thing to do. The idea was to make 5 or 8 articles out of it, and, you know, so that there would be a lot of titles. Now, this seemed to me so silly and counterproductive and bogus that I assumed that everybody would recognize what was going on and would devalue it. But in fact, what I saw was that this was expected, and it was demanded.
Hmm.
And if you were, you know, if you just wrote one excellent article, this would be counted against you because, you know, somebody else had written, you know, less material in 5 articles. So there were lots of things like that. There were lots of ways in which form and manipulation were credited when they should really have been laughed at or disparaged. And that surprised me, and it seemed to kind of distort what was happening and, you know, that kind of thing.
Okay. One other thing you mentioned in the article is that at various times certain research methods are considered trendy, and
yes,
it's important
right.
to incorporate them, and that, you know, there's a certain trendiness, and if you're doing more old-fashioned work or you're sort of outside of those trends, your work isn't considered as important.
Yeah, I saw that happen, and I found it amazing that people, meaning my faculty colleagues, who were intelligent and, you know, seemed to me, you know, that they should be able to see straight about these things, would just go ahead and, you know, follow along with these ideas, with these trends, and, you know, it seemed like a shame. But, you know, that's really the way things were. One thing that, this is not exactly relevant, but I would add it to the situation that I found myself in when I was coming up for tenure. As I described, there was an area of research work that was quite new, and in fact, you know, time has shown that that area was then became very important in subsequent years in my field, developmental biology. Anyway, this had to do with studying the spatial localization of molecules in different parts of frog eggs. This was a new area and for me, and when it was evaluated at tenure time, the feedback I got about it later was that the faculty were worried about this because they, you know, this was different from what other people had been doing, and, you know, although it looked like a good idea, where was this going to go, and how could they have confidence in it, and they didn't know what the future would bring, and so forth. Okay, then there was the area of limb regeneration, which was following up on work I had done as a graduate student and under my mentor, who was a famous biologist. And so there, the feedback was, I found out later, well, this is good, and we know that it's productive, but, you know, maybe this is just her mentor's ideas. You know, we can't really credit her with this because, you know, she brought this with her from mm-hmm. graduate school. So it seemed that I couldn't win. You know, if I went in a new direction, they were worried about, well, where is this going to go? And if I pursued older directions, then
it wasn't
I couldn't
original.
Really get credit for it.
Yeah, it wasn't.
You know, and this is an example of how much of a contrast there was between the way my work was evaluated and that of males. And I think this is an example also of how unconscious prejudice works.
Mm-hmm.
I think that because I was a woman, it was hard for them to have confidence in what I was doing. And so that then created this sort of conundrum about, you know, we can't trust her with new work and we can't credit her for old work.
Mm, okay. Now, when reading your article, I know that some feminists, and I'm not sure if that's still true, but at one point were almost on the point of discouraging women from entering science, the sort of hopelessness about science. Well, it's hopelessly male, and so women should pursue other areas. It seemed like in this article you took a different approach, and you still wanted to encourage women to pursue science. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. And I must say that I was not aware that feminists were discouraging women from going into science. I mean, in my experience, the most serious critics of the male science establishment would have said, don't join the establishment, women. Make your own science. You know, be pioneers in a feminist science. I really didn't come in contact with people who were saying, leave science to the men and become artists or something like that.
Okay.
Definitely, I mean, women. Anyway, it wouldn't matter if I told women not to go into science. I mean, women there have always been women who were really drawn to science and found it fascinating and did great work in it. The problem has been, you know, getting credit and getting into the institutions. And, in fact, things are not quite as bad as I think as they were, you know, 20 years ago. I mean, there are more women in the science establishment now, and of course, that doesn't mean they have free rein to do things exactly the way they want to, and women also come under the influence of these trends that beset men, but, or that are more part of male culture, but, you know, things evolve, and yeah, science is a very fertile field for women.
Now, you say that things have improved. To what do you attribute these improvements?
I think, you know, the evolution of society. I mean, the position of women has changed enormously. My mother, who was very self-confident and aggressive and successful, was tortured by guilt because she wasn't at home as a housekeeper, as a homemaker. And, you know, I think we spoke about before, the human mind can hold a lot of contradictory beliefs and act on all of them. And, you know, my mother wanted to go out in the world and earn a living and, you know, do something interesting and so forth. And she did, and she was great at it, and she knew she was. But she also berated herself for not being the homemaker that was featured on television in the 50s. And, you know, I forgot why. Where am I going with this? What'd you ask me?
But the evolution of women's roles.
Right, so society evolves, and now, for example, you know, there's much more acknowledgement by society that women have ambitions and creativity, and they should be able to have careers and, you know, the way men do, and that society should adjust to that, and in the university that, you know, faculties and administrators have become much more aware, first of all, that women are very productive and important in these fields, and that they have a right to the same careers under the same conditions as men. And also, administrators and faculty have become much more aware of hidden forms of discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
I you know, when I accused the zoology department of discrimination in my tenure process, they were absolutely outraged because discrimination is sort of the opposite of objectivity, and as scientists, they considered themselves to be totally objective and beyond the possibility of prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
Now, part of the problem here is that a lot of what was going on was not exactly intended. I'm sure that nobody said, even to themselves, let alone out loud, she's a woman, we don't want her on the faculty. I really don't think so, even in the 70s. But there was a lot of less conscious prejudice, you know, because there were different expectations for what men do and what women do, and different expectations about behavior. I don't think that the male faculty realized how much their ideas about what a faculty member should be doing was associated with the way males are trained to behave, things which don't really help science particularly, but which, you know, are just part of men jockeying for position.
Okay.
And I think there were things they didn't realize. And also, the department had a history of having women working for them, not in tenured positions, but to do the supportive stuff in the department, you know, to handle the supplies and do the most basic teaching and do research in the laboratories headed by men. And they didn't realize that these expectations were still hooked to women who they allowed to, or were sort of goaded into putting on the tenure track faculty.
Okay. So how optimistic are you about the future of women in science?
Oh, I think that, women will become a more important part of the scientific establishment. There are going to continue to be conflicts, but I think that women will, just as in the rest of society, that women will have more important positions than they did 20, 30 years ago, will have a chance to influence things to a greater extent. But this sort of wrestling between different psychological tendencies is going to exist. And it's not just between men and women. You see it in government, too. You have women in fairly high positions in government, but, of course, you know, many more men are at the top, and you know, there are various aspects of society that make it easier for men to get to the top and give them more motivation to get to the top, and so they have more control about things. But it's not just women and men. I mean, men aren't all the same. Men have a diversity of characteristics, and we see in the United States now, you know, that they're, at the moment we are held captive by a group of men who value war and conflict and dominance enormously, and not all the men are in the country are satisfied with this, but they have hold of things now, and, you know, there's a conflict about how long are they going to be in control of the country's programs, and I think that will exist in science, too, that there will be tendencies to keep science very authoritarian and structured in a top-down way, but, mm-hmm. you know, resistance to it, too, and I think that women will have a gradual influence on the way science is done, but, you know, I'm quite sure I'm not going to live to see science in the ideal way that I would like to see it.
Now, do you have any final comments you want to make about perhaps your career here or your career since you've been here?
No, I liked working at the University of Wisconsin a lot. I think it was at the time, certainly, and I presume, I think to a large extent still now, you know, a really excellent institution in the biomedical sciences with a very large research establishment. And also I liked very much the way it was organized. The administration was, in general, very supportive of the faculty. And I like Madison a lot. So I'm very sorry that things didn't work out. And I think I was, you know, sort of, I mean, on the one hand, I was very lucky to come out on the job market at a time when universities like Wisconsin were all of a sudden under pressure to hire women to the tenured faculty in science departments. So this outside influence gave me an access, it gave me job offers from a lot of places that might not have been so quick to offer me a job had it not been at this particular moment.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, 6 or 7 years later, I got axed because this process of opening the system to women was only partially successful by that moment. And so, you know, I was one of the women who, you know, lost out. But, you know, it's part of the ride.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your time. I greatly appreciate this, and this will be an important addition to our collection.
Well, thanks, Joyce. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Yes.